From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Pope Francis is visiting the United States and addressed Congress, the first Catholic pontiff to do so, and traveled to New York, where he addressed the United Nations. In Washington, he urged American leaders to take in more immigrants, tackle the issue of climate change, and abolish the death penalty. And he made a point of contacting the Little Sisters of the Poor and endorsed their request for nuns to be given a conscience exemption to the conception mandate in the health care law. His visit was followed by the arrival in Washington of Chinese President Xi Jinping. He and President Obama have numerous issues to discuss, including a new code of cyber conduct. Meanwhile, the campaign for the presidency in 2016 in the United States saw Hillary Clinton lose ground and new insults from Donald Trump. Well, let's start with the Pope, which was, I think, I'll start with you, David, a dazzling visit. You're not Catholic, are you?
I am not.
I'm not either. How about you, Tim?
No, I'm not Catholic.
Okay, we're all non-Catholics. But that doesn't mean weren't impressed with the Pope. I certainly disagree with some of his political views, but I think it was a dazzling performance by him. An hour-long speech spoken in English. I was impressed.
That's right. This was not a protocol visit. This was a visit where he had a message tailored to this country very precisely, a country which is not only full of Catholics, but full of unusual Catholics, very individualistic Catholics.
You mean cafeteria Catholics?
Well, no, but also, you know, Americans in general, to generalize, they're very individualistic. They don't like being told what to do, particularly by a foreigner miles away. And so it's always tricky for a pope, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can't assume that American Catholics are like every other. It's a church that has some very conservative people in it. It's a church that has some very strongly democratic voting people mm-hmm. in it. I think by, you know, the classic Washington line, if you've upset everybody on the right and the left, you're probably doing something right. And that's basically what he did with this long policy-packed speech to Congress. He had Democrats sitting on their hands unhappily when he talked about the sanctity of life at all stages of human mm-hmm. development. He then had Republicans several times looking pretty miserable when he talked about climate change and the death penalty. So I think that, you know, from his perspective, he strode a very careful line.
Well, there's some conservatives, like myself, who find it very easy to ignore his liberal political views because I take him very seriously, even though I'm not a Catholic, on spiritual matters.
But isn't that too glib? Because I think that for him, climate change is absolutely a spiritual matter. And it is a spiritual matter because it's also the case that some of the opposition, some of the strongest opposition in this country, America, to the idea that climate change is something that we need to tackle mm-hmm. comes from evangelical Christians and Protestants who would make a religious case I have interviewed evangelical Protestants who have said very passionately that you know if God can part the Red mm-hmm. Sea, he can cope with the degree of change in temperature here and there, and it's kind of blasphemous to worry too much about, you know, these little changes to the climate.
All
so
right,
I think he has a perfect right to talk about climate.
Well,
change.
He has a right to talk about it, no question about that. Well, Tim, what is climate change a spiritual issue?
I'm not going to weigh into that one. I think you guys have gotten deep enough into that. I mean, I think the thing that appeals about the Pope is that he's reaching out to people the Catholic Church wouldn't have typically reached out to. We're talking rich people, poor people, sick people.
Political
people
liberals.
Political
liberals. No, I think that was clearly, that's a part of the group that he wants to bring into the orbit of the Catholic Church very strongly.
Yeah, but he's reaching out both to Catholics and people who are not Catholics.
Yep.
What really struck me was, you know, there were thousands of people waiting in front of the Capitol for hours and hours outside just for a few minutes of the Pope's presence. And mm-hmm. when the Pope did come out, he said, if you're Catholic, please pray for me. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, or you can't pray, send me good wishes.
Yeah.
And I felt that that was very deeply moving, that he was appealing not only to his, you know, base, if you will, but also to anyone who might be out there who might be seeing what he's doing. And he's doing a very impressive job reaching out to the sick, the poor, the oppressed. And when he gave a speech before Congress, he touched upon some issues that very rarely get addressed. I mean, before a Congress where hundreds of these lawmakers have gotten a lot of money from Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, these big arms dealers, he said, we need to stop the global trade of arms. Mm. I mean, I that's not a topic.
He said it was drenched in blood. Money drenched in blood.
Yeah, and that's not a topic that gets raised in the U.S. Congress very often. I thought that was very interesting.
I guess I should have mentioned that in the introduction, because he made a great point of that. But here's another question about the Pope, David, and that is, how influential is he in 2015?
Well, that's in some ways a painful question for religious leaders in a country like this, because, I mean, the really interesting thing about this Pope is so much of it, as Tim says, is about his tone and his humility and his kind of very public focus on, you know, reaching out to people who are not his own flock. Because actually, if you take a checklist of his views on gay marriage, on abortion, on the role of women in the church, he is no more liberal than his predecessors. He has not changed church doctrine. And yet he is so much more powerful, so much more popular, so much sort of more heeded by, as you say, non-religious people or political mm-hmm. liberals. Mm-hmm. And it's about that tone. It's about that humility. Mm-hmm. He says, well, this is what I believe, but who am I to judge? This is what I believe, but I'm not going to impose it on someone else. An amazing contrast with his predecessor, Pope Benedict, who, when he was, before Pope Benedict was Pope, he was head of the sort of the discipline arm of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. there's Cardinal Ratzinger, who had terrible fights with American bishops. If you remember, a decade ago, there was a fight about discipline in the American Church, and he summoned the American Catholic bishops to Rome and said, the Roman Church is not a democracy. And, you know, it was laying down the law. And you remember the fights between the Catholic hierarchy and, mm-hmm. and sort of more liberal nuns in mm-hmm. America. All of that changed by this Pope's kind of tone and mm-hmm. his humility.
Should he have spent more time? He mentioned this, I believe, when he got to New York, or maybe he mentioned it here, too. I'm in Washington. I'm referring to the sex abuse scandal. I know there were some reports in the newspaper after he had left in the media, Tim, that suggested that he should have said more about that.
Obviously, there's no end to the amount of apologies that could be offered for such a terrible incident. Should he have said more? I just think that he touched on so many different topics. It didn't strike me as something that was outstanding. He could have talked about it more, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What about that, David?
I think that you did see some sincere voices raised. So particularly, I think he struck a bad note, one of the few bad notes he struck, when he kind of praised the priests for their courage in dealing with this. And I think that probably, you know, if you're choosing people to sort of give a shout-out to, it's not the priests.
I interpreted that he praised the courage of the other priests who suffered for what the sex abusers had done.
That's the problem is, I mean, I covered this, you know, 12 years ago in Boston. Mm. I did some work on this and read some internal church documents that some lawyers had subpoenaed and got hold of. It was really shocking the way that the hierarchy covered this
up. Yeah, and well, we know that now, yes. It didn't know it 12 years ago the way we do now. Okay, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more issues in the news.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Tim Mack and David Rennie. I could talk about the Pope's visit all day. Tim, Democratic liberals are cheering this, that he may have some impact on the way the climate change issue is handled by Congress and politicians. Is that likely?
Well, he's sort of reshaped the way that we view the debate, but I don't think that it's going to change the political calculus here in Washington, D.C., I don't know about other world capitals, but here in Washington, D.C., I think you're going to go back to business as usual pretty quickly, mm-hmm. even after the Pope's admonition to take the environment more seriously.
Okay, we're going to turn to China. David, you were in China for The Economist. What years were you there?
I was there actually for the Daily Telegraph, is before I joined The Economist. I was there from 98 to 2002.
Mm-hmm. Has China changed? There's an editorial in The Wall Street Journal that says, you know, the journal has over the years really promoted integration with China in trade and so on.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch, the owner of the journal, is a huge kind of China player and has mm-hmm. has long tried to forge business links with the Communist
yeah.
Party there.
Well, what about China now? You know, I mean, she it seems to be more aggressive, even more belligerent than earlier so Xi Jinping, Chinese presidents.
Xi Jinping is an extraordinary figure. He is probably the most powerful central leader of China since Deng Xiaoping, certainly, but even, you know, arguably has amassed more formal power than anyone since Chairman Mao.
Then didn't everybody expect him to be sort of a good old boy when he came in?
Well, he came after a fairly kind of lackluster predecessor, but what he has done is he has set up, he's given himself control over the military, over the party, and over the sort of state apparatus, and really centralized power, and also taken a very hard sort of authoritarian nationalist line, and sold the Chinese people on this idea of what he calls the Chinese dream, Zhongguo Meng, which is, you know, his tribute to the American dream, but it's a very authoritarian vision. Now, when you talk to people in the White House about how they find Xi Jinping, they say there's good and bad to his self-confidence and his strength. The good thing is that they feel that under Xi, you can get stuff done on issues like climate change, where previous Chinese presidents, whenever it got too hard, tended to say, oh, well, we're just a third world country, you can't expect too much for us. Xi kind of follows the logic of his China great power sort of argument to the point that he is willing to make great power commitments. So in that respect, he's easier for the Americans to deal with. The problem comes where there are clashes, which are essentially kind of clashes of two sovereign states, two superpowers, over things like these reefs that they're building up in the South China Sea to build airstrips. There, you're dealing with a much more assertive, much more openly assertive Chinese leader, breaking with that long tradition that China had of quietly getting rich, quietly building up its military, and biding its time until it was sort of strong enough to show its hand.
I want to read you something, Tim, and you, David, too. Something from the Wall Street Journal, an editorial that appeared when she appeared in Washington, and it said this. It said, these columns have rooted for China's emergence as a major U.S. trading partner and responsible global power since Deng Xiaoping became the first Chinese communist leader to visit the United States in 1979. Then it moves on. But it is now impossible to ignore that China is attempting to redefine its relationship to America and the rules of world order. Under Mr. Xi, Beijing sees itself as a strategic rival than a partner. Its foreign policy is increasingly aggressive, sometimes lawless, a reality that's become clear even to the Obama administration. And this is a very long editorial which goes along, which continues in that tone. What about it? Is there a redefinition of the relationship with America by China, do you think?
There seems to be a lot of antagonism in the military sphere. David mentioned the conflicts that we've seen in the South China Sea, but also in the cybersphere, that in the cyber domain, we're seeing unprecedented levels of intellectual property theft by Chinese companies, backed by the Chinese government. We see the breaches of major and important government databases with sensitive information that kind of look into the backgrounds of Americans. It does seem increasingly antagonistic. These are the sorts of issues that the presidents of both countries need to work out while Xi Jinping is in the country.
Would you go as far, David, as to say that China is trying to redefine the relationship?
I think it's inevitable. I mean, I think the short version of what China thinks about the world is China thinks it's China's turn. Mm-hmm. They think that the West has had a long run of supremacy and American-led hegemony, and it's China's turn. And at some point, it's not that China is planning a war with America. It's not that China is planning to invade California. China's plan is to become strong enough and rich enough that, at least in its own region, it's the veto power, that America has to keep its distance, and that China gets a say on what happens in its hemisphere of the world. And they are extraordinarily self-interested and extraordinarily ruthless in that approach.
But it's not just the United States that wants to prevent that. Yeah, I think it's so many countries in Asia, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Malaysia.
No, for sure. And you're seeing one of the fascinating developments the last few years is, the famous Asia pivot, where the Obama administration said that it needed to devote more attention to Asia after the Bush years and the focus on the Middle East. I think one of the things that isn't sufficiently appreciated here when people say, oh, was that a smart move or not a smart move? The impetus for the Asia pivot came from Asia. It was countries in Asia begging America to be much more present, because they don't want to fight with China, but they certainly don't want America to leave them on their own with China. But, China has 1.3 billion people. I mean, that's a very, very big country. So even though it's still got a lot of catching up to do, it's inevitable that China is going to be one of the most powerful countries in the world. I mean, what was unusual, what was an anomaly, was that because Chairman Mao basically kicked the Chinese economy to death with some of the worst policies ever inflicted on a major economy, it was abnormally small. China is just taking its natural place.
I remember the Great Leap Forward, which was economically a great leap backward.
Great Leap Backward and famines, man-made famines caused by Chairman Mao. Mm-hmm.
Well, certainly that's not a part of the Chinese dream now, that's for sure. I don't know how historic a visit this is going to be, but would a new code of cyber conduct really amount to much and lead to anything? I'm a little dubious that any kind of small agreement is going to change the relationship between America and China.
And, I mean, the Chinese do insist that they are not involved in this sort of cyber espionage, which is, as far as we can tell, totally untrue.
Mm-hmm.
A new agreement doesn't mean anything if they're not going to abide by it.
We have to be precise, though. There's three different things at play here. There's cyber espionage.
Right.
And the truth is that American officials, when it comes to China literally just spying on things like the data of secret officials.
Yeah.
That's the rules of the game. Everyone does that.
Yeah,
there's cyber theft, which is the Americans say, don't do that for commercial interest, and we don't do that. The thing that I think we may see an agreement on is cyber sabotage, which is actually going in peacetime and sort of shutting down a power station or messing with networks. And that, I think, both powers do have a self-interest as big grown-up powers in agreeing not to do that.
We're going to take another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with David Rennie and Tim Mack. We're going to turn to politics. You know, many people around the world remember Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of them do favorably when she was Secretary of State. And now she's running for the second time for the Democratic presidential nomination and not doing well. I was surprised, David, to see that she, taking into account that public opinion polls of potential voters months before the first vote will occur, which is February 1st in Iowa, they're pretty unreliable. But she's fallen about 16 points behind a somewhat obscure senator, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, in New Hampshire, which has the second event on February 9th. I mean, nothing seems to be halting her free fall.
Well, I mean, if Bernie Sanders were a much more viable candidate, if Hillary Clinton had a rival who was, say, you know, 48, 49, 50, was a governor from a kind of reasonably big state, was just a little bit to her left and so could appeal to kind of disenchanted party base and was charismatic and a good talker, then she would be in a world of pain. She would be in real trouble, because the truth is that the vast majority of Democratic activists, they're not wildly excited about Hillary Clinton. They want to win very badly. They want to beat Republicans very badly. But the number of kind of diehard, kind of, I'm so excited it's Hillary again people is pretty small.
Indeed.
But here's the thing. That viable rival doesn't exist. And Bernie Sanders that you mention, who is, you know, challenging her in some opinion polls, the truth is, all of us around this table know, he will not be the nominee. He is way too far to the left to be the nominee. So he is a kind of a protest vote at the moment for Democratic people before they fall in line behind Hillary Clinton. And one of the striking things when you talk to Republicans and Democrats in this race is that the Democrats are the ones who are all disciplined this time. They sort of say, well, you know, we're not that happy with her, but we really want to win. They're much more kind of disciplined mood, the grassroots activists on the Democratic side, than on the Republican side, where there's still this kind of pitchfork and flaming torch kind of mood.
I wonder what these activists that David's talking about, Tim, think about polls that show by a 2-1 margin, roughly, the American voters think that she's not honest.
Well, a lot of that has to do with this email controversy that's erupted over the last few months. The idea that she had her own private server on which she conducted official government business outside of the general rules of what is allowed at the State Department when she was Secretary of State. And this slow drip, 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 these emails coming out through Freedom of Information requests. Now the news that we're hearing this week about the FBI recovering some of the data that's been erased on her server. All of this plays into this narrative that she's been in government too long and she is not to be trusted.
Okay, well, we'll see. I certainly don't think she's out of the picture, but I think the calculation that you mentioned, David, that at the end of the day, Sanders is not going to win the Democratic nomination doesn't apply to Vice President Biden if he jumps in the race.
Well, that's another interesting question. I mean, is he really a viable nominee? I mean,
yes.
The idea of Joe Biden is often better than the reality.
Yeah, he's an underdog.
You know, he's a terrible campaigner. He's run terrible campaigns before. Mm-hmm. He's self-indulgent. He rambles on. He can lose a room by going on too long. He makes gaffes. He is not young. He's also, if your big problem as Hillary Clinton is people in the left of your party who are angry about, you know, Wall Street didn't see all the bankers jailed and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, partly because he was from Delaware, which has a lot of finance companies and credit card companies, Joe Biden was a better friend to Wall Street than most Democrats.
Yeah.
He was a law and order, pro-police, lock him up and throw away the key kind of Democrat. So he doesn't actually fix that many of the problems for very disgruntled, very left-wing Democrats.
All right, we'll get to now what I know both of you want to talk about, and you're probably wondering why I've taken so long to raise the question of Donald Trump, who is the running number one in all the polls. And look, he has to be called the front runner now since he's been leading in these polls for, a couple of months. He has now picked on Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who's 44 years old. Trump is, I think, 69. And he's called him sweaty, overly ambitious, financially unsuccessful, kid, a lightweight, and a number of other things. Some guy who drinks too much water, even. What about this? I mean, I mean, Trump has carried on this campaign of insults of other candidates. I'm not sure it's going to continue to work in the case of Marco Rubio. It didn't work against Carly Fiorina. That blew up in Trump's face. Well, anyway, what about this Trump campaign?
Well, this is very much part of the Trump playbook. When things go bad for Donald Trump, he reacts back with fire. He just comes back with insults that are frequently personal. He goes after the sweatiness of Marco Rubio, the lack of energy of Jeb Bush, the face of Carly Fiorina. And the question is, how long will this work? I mean, he's been a genius in terms of being able to harness media attention towards his campaign through extravagance. But the question is whether this game can continue on for very long.
I think how this will end is Donald Trump will not be the nominee, and this will end because at some point, when his poll numbers start to fall a bit and when he gets asked too many harsh questions in a row, he will, like the little boy in the park, he will sulk, he will not be enjoying it anymore, and he will pick up his ball and he'll go home. I think that's what's going to happen, because I think that he only enjoys this when it's all going easily for him.
You know,
he has a very thin skin.
Of course he does. But, you know, all these predictions about, he said John McCain's not a hero, his campaign will crash, and all these
things,
they've all been wrong.
I'm not saying it will happen soon. I mean, who knows when it will happen. I've given up trying to make sort of firm predictions about Donald Trump's implosion. There was a brilliant detail in a new fairly trashy biography of Donald Trump that came out where they spoke to one of his ex-wives, and she talks about going skiing with him, and she was a former ski champion, Ivana Trump, and she overtook him on the ski slope.
Uh-oh.
And he was so upset at being overtaken by his own wife that he immediately took his skis off and walked off. Mm-hmm. Just walked off the mountain.
Well, he would respond if you asked him, hey, she was a loser.
She's
I'm
a loser. Yeah,
but I'm a winner.
But I think that's the key to him. I would also say that Marco Rubio, if you forced me to make, if you put a gun to my head and said, choose the next nominee, I think Marco Rubio, I've been saying for months, could be the next nominee. So I think, you know, calling him sweaty and stuff, It's not gonna stop Marco Rubio. If Rubio is smart, he will not really respond.
And let's see what he says. Here's what he said. He said Trump takes shots at everybody that gets anywhere close to him in terms of a poll, or any time he hits a rough spot, that's what he does. And Rubio suggested that Trump's 10-second soundbite campaign is wearing thin. Anyway, that's all the time we have. I'm sure we'll come back to Trump in some other day. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.